Good morning. House Committee on Revenue will come to order March 13, 2009. We open a public hearing on House Bill 2914. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's always good to be talking taxes on Friday the 13th. But House Bill 2914 is a federal connect bill. It reestablishes the rolling reconnect to the definition of taxable income, essentially kind of unwinding what House Bill 2157 put into law. And it also contains in there a date for the non-taxable income related provisions. And right now it's just a placeholder. It has a date of December 31st, 2009. So that's really just a placeholder right now because that date would have to be some date that is in the past. And that's essentially what the bill does.
Wonderful. Colleagues, we opened this bill this morning partly to get to begin a conversation on the issue, but also because within that rubric fits the CPA's analysis, and so we'd like to hear from them next. And it looks like Carrie Schoenfeld and Keith Myers.
Yes.
Have I got that right? Please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schoenfeld, and I am a CPA and a tax attorney practicing in the Portland and Southwest Washington area. And with me is Keith Myers, and he's a CPA practicing in the Portland area as well. And this year I also am the chair of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and Keith is the chair of the legislative section. So we are well-versed in this. So I think we just wanted to give you an overview today and answer any questions that we might on the newest stimulus act and kind of the tax impact that it may have on Oregon. You also, I think, have a copy of this that the tax committee spent a lot of time putting together. This covers bills that have passed in both 2007 and 2008 and kind of gives an overview. Now, this was already picked up in House Bill... was it 2157 that was already passed? So we will not go through that today, but hopefully if you've got any constituents that have questions, it's got kind of a highlight of some of the provisions that were passed in that. And so what we wanted to focus on today instead is the handout that you have that kind of does an overview of the latest stimulus bill, which passed in February. And so at this time, Oregon is not tied to that, and we just wanted to go through that and kind of highlight some of the income tax provisions that will kind of pass through. So with that, I think initially, starting on page one, this is listed in code section references, and so the first several pages just have to do with federal tax credits that will not impact Oregon directly. I think in the legislative impact analysis that you have, there will be some indirect pass-throughs because to the extent that taxpayers receive credits, it may mean that they have more taxable income to be taxed in Oregon, and Oregon would actually receive more dollars. But they won't have any direct impact. There's no direct tie, and we usually don't tie to those credits. And so really that takes us the first six pages, five pages, pretty much covers just credits and issues with alternative minimum tax, which again is just a federal income tax rate that will not affect Oregon. And so we feel that beginning on page six at the top, code section 85 for the unemployment compensation is sort of the first section that we get to that we feel will have an impact in Oregon. And that provision basically states that the first $2,400 of unemployment compensation would be excluded from gross income for 2009 for individuals. And so by not connecting, then the individuals would need to add that back into Oregon income, and it would be taxed in Oregon income. And I think just as a kind of a overview of where we were, we would really encourage the committee to consider conformity because when we do disconnect, it becomes extremely difficult, not only for the taxpayer, so for this individual who may be unemployed, but also for the CPAs and our clients when we're trying to prepare the tax returns. And we'll try to kind of highlight some of those issues as we go along. So that unemployment compensation is one that would flow through, because if we are not connected, it would be an add back. If we are connected, it would be deducted for Oregon purposes, and again, I think there would be a little bit of a revenue loss there. The next one is income from discharge of indebtedness. And what happens there is when a taxpayer has an obligation, perhaps to a bank, and they owe $200,000 to the bank, if the bank says, we'll accept $100,000 in exchange for that note and we'll allow that to be paid off, the taxpayer then has taxable income to the extent of $100,000 to the extent that the bank forgave that debt. And so this provision says that to the extent there is that relief of debt, and I think that just the thought that there can be a lot of that this year, the taxpayer is able to kind of allocate that over a five-year period so that it doesn't hit all in this year. So this one, there would be a revenue loss in 2009, but it's a timing issue, and it would eventually be picked back up. So that's the income from discharge of indebtedness. I think the others, there's a few other provisions on that page, none of which are real important pieces, I think, that will really impact Oregon. One is certain fringe benefits for transit passes, a small provision.
Excuse me. Before we go on, if I understood what you correctly about Code Section 108, change it from a taxable income. It simply defers the time in which you have to report it?
Correct. And so you would still be reporting it, over a five-year period, rather than if the whole debt was forgiven this year, it would usually be included all in this year.
Right.
And so for federal purposes, it would now be deferred over a five-year period. And so it would be included in income, but over a five-year period.
Okay. Thank you. Now I understand.
But it is. Yeah. So.
Yes, Representative Berger.
So the impact in Oregon would be, in Oregon, that it would remain in the, how does it play out when you get to the Oregon returns?
Under the current rule.
So under the current rule
where we are disconnected. Yeah.
Correct. So as being disconnected, there would have to be a separate line item on the Oregon return, along with a whole lot of other Oregon separate line items, it would and be required to add back probably four-fifths of it. So instead of $100,000 on federal, you'd have to add back $80,000 of taxable income for Oregon. And then that would carry over, and there would have to be a separate line for the
Subtraction
for the next 4 years. And so that's where disconnect, we suddenly have a lot of impact that's going to have to be tracked for several years. And that's, again, I think why, to the extent we can, and we realize there's revenue impacts you need to consider, but the conformity can be so critical for even our residents, but also those that are reporting income from out of state that aren't aware of our differences. We find that a lot of times they don't pick those up and they actually get a benefit because they're not really reporting it correctly.
Thank you.
Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps a illustration of this 108 device would help everyone, especially me.
Kind of just to clarify. So again, if I've got a mortgage and I owe $200,000 on that mortgage.
Forgive me for interrupting. I wanted to say hello and make the committee know that I've known Ms. Schoenfeld for a long time. We've worked together on many different projects. And so I'm happy to see you here.
Thank you.
But could you use, like, this has to be a business deduction, if I recall. If this, it says business indebtedness. So this would not be a personal residence?
Probably not a personal residence, but usually even on individuals have cancellation of indebtedness income as well. So, but if you put it into a business context where they have a 200,000 line operating line of credit, the business has gone down, can't pay that back, and the bank says, we'll accept $100,000 if you can pay that off this year and we'll cancel that note. Maybe it's a bank that's gone under and they're trying to get the money back. Generally, it's going to be a business that's suffering and they're not able to pay it back, but by some mechanism, they may be able to get some additional contributions in from a shareholder and pay that off. And so the bank is willing to forgive that extra debt. So when they forgive that $100,000 of debt, generally, it would all be that $100,000 would be included in taxable income in 2009. And under the federal provision, only $20,000 would be included in 2009 and $20,000 in 2010 in the next 3 years. Whereas under Oregon law currently, it would all $100,000 would need to be included in 2009 for taxable income. And then in subsequent years, As Chair Barnhart said, we would have to have a reduction for Oregon taxes in the subsequent years.
Thank you.
So. Yes, please, Representative Berger.
Thank you. Would you please explain your comment that this 108 is business only, or is it any indebtedness? It's in your thing. It says business indebtedness. So does your home thing work? I know we're wading in heavy water.
I don't think I can answer that. As it's stated here, it's specifically business indebtedness.
And for the record, would you state your name for us?
Keith Myers, CPA, Portland, Oregon.
Right.
For business indebtedness, it would, in essence, be for any small business. And your specific question on if it would be applicable for a personal residence in this situation, I don't know. I don't recall, and Carrie might be going through on that. But her example of the $100,000, the impact as far as the time period is concerned would stretch out over a five-year period. You would have the fact that there would be no federal income in the first year. It would all be state income for forgiveness of debt in that first year. And then on the federal purposes, be picked up over the next 5 years because it's spread out over a five-year period. So it's not really it's not a situation where the federal government does not allow or just assumes that the deduction goes away. The federal government does pick it up, but it's over a longer period of time.
I did find it is just those that either relate to a corporation or an indebtedness related to business or trade.
Okay.
So under 108, I mean, it is much broader than that, but this specific provision is just business.
Okay.
So you're correct.
That, Mr. Chair, that is significant in terms of how many of these are out there.
Right.
In other words, the size of the universe in Oregon that would be impacted, I think, is makes a big difference if it's only business indebted.
And an awful lot of times, if I may, on the business indebtedness, usually you're not going to have a bank forgive a loan unless they've gone under. So they've got a loss to begin with. So it's kind of just offsetting that loss. And we generally will see it, or the business is completely out of business, and so it doesn't have a huge impact. But it doesn't allow them to take a loss that would kind of offset that income. So, I mean, when you're dealing in that context, you're really only going to forgive a debt when it's a dire circumstance.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask you if you could explain the choice that businesses face when they reach this point in their unwinding or restructuring, generally, is how I've seen it. So if they had this opportunity to spread the tax out for the 5 years, then maybe do you think that it would make it more likely that they might stay in business as opposed to choose the bankruptcy alternative, which is where this choice usually, this is a discussion that seems to usually happen when they're on the edge of bankruptcy. Do you think that this gives them another tool to use to avoid bankruptcy?
Well, certainly it does, because it's when you're looking at the taxable income and whether they can use the dollars for paying payroll or paying the taxes, if they've got that offset again, if they're having to include it in income. And we find that it's a real surprise to most businesses and individuals when they have to include this income. They think they've negotiated this with the bank and they've got a deal and they're not going to have to pay it, and suddenly it turns around and hits them on the income side and they're having to pay the tax on it. And I don't know about you, Keith, but most of my clients, it's kind of a surprise that, what do you mean I'm going to have to now pay tax? So at least if they can defer that.
Yeah, the cash flow in these situations is really the big key. This is a situation where the business is in dire straits to begin with, and it's almost sort of adding insult to injury when you find out that, oh, my God, I just did what I could to renegotiate with the bank, so I'm finally forward, and all of a sudden I've got to pay tax on an additional $100,000 of income. It is difficult.
Representative Riley.
Understandably difficult. However, what this is they got a loan at some point, so they actually had cash coming in, mm-hmm. and now they didn't pay tax on it when they got it because it wasn't income; it was a loan. And now that loan's forgiven. There's $100,000 in this instance we're talking about. There's $100,000 worth of cash influx into that business they never paid tax on at this point.
You're absolutely right, Representative Riley. This is, they received money at some form at some time in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the forgiveness of debt means that they do not have to pay it back. This provision doesn't forgive the fact that that income is there. It just allows for a longer period of time to recognize the income from it.
Okay. Right. One of the reasons I think why members of the committee are so interested in whether this is only for business debt or for personal debt as well is that, and correct me if I misstated, but it seems to me that this basic rule of taxation applies not only to discharge of business indebtedness, but also to discharge of personal indebtedness. If that's and I'm getting a head nod. So if that's true, one of the conversations that's being had nationally right now is about the business of rewriting mortgages for people who are underwater. One possibility, of course, is forgiveness of principal. That would trigger an income item, would it not, for those individuals?
Yes.
And they would have the same problem in that, unless there's some other rule somewhere further on that changes that as well, they would have to recognize that income immediately and pay the tax on it.
Yes.
In the first year.
Mm-hmm. And there is not any other rule. This is the only one this time. Now it may be that something pops up later, but we're not hearing anything about that. And typically for the homes, especially for, I mean, a lot of times that forgiveness is going to be much smaller than for a business. But again, it's still taxpayers that are having real troubles.
Well, as housing prices come down, it mm-hmm. might surprise you how
yes.
large those can get.
There's gonna...
Thank you. Unless there's another question, go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. So moving on, I think down at the bottom on Section 164, I think, is the next one that really has much impact. Really, this doesn't have an impact in Oregon, but just to point out, this is just an additional deduction for sales and excise taxes, and just want to note that for Oregon, we already add that back, and so that won't have any impact in Oregon. I think the other provisions there are... nothing that will have a great impact in Oregon. So then we're going to turn it over to page 7, and I'm going to turn it over to Keith to pick up there.
At the top of page 7, Code Section 168, these are the large items when it comes to revenue impact for Oregon. The Section 168 sub K discusses the extension of the 50% bonus, what we call bonus depreciation, when a business owner acquires a new asset and puts it into service. Normally, that's depreciated over a 5 or 7 year period of time for most situations. And for this equipment, they can elect to have bonus depreciation, in essence, accelerating the amount of depreciation that they can have and deductions that they have in that first year, allowing them to reduce their taxes that way. We're disconnected from that bonus depreciation at this point. So for federal purposes, the depreciation deduction would be higher than in Oregon in this year. Next section down, Section 172, net operating losses. Oregon has its own carryback for net operating losses, so the revenue impact here is... What is the revenue impact here? Do you remember? Yeah.
It's from what legislative revenue has come up.
Yeah, it's a much smaller revenue impact on here. The next larger big one is Section 179, which is the expensing of purchasing of equipment that's placed into service. In this case, it would be after 2008. It was extended. The $250,000 limitation was extended with the stimulus package. So Oregon is disconnected from the standpoint that now it's $100,000, back to what the old law was a few years ago. And the revenue impact here is this is a timing issue as well. I mean, it will be picked up eventually, but. And it's difficult to understand what the revenue impact with this would be, especially in the 2009 year. For Section 179, if a business takes that deduction, they cannot create a loss with it. So let's say that they have income of $200,000 after all of their deductions this year, and they buy a piece of equipment for $250,000, and they elect to take the Section 179 deduction, they can't deduct the $250,000 from the $200,000 and create a $50,000 tax loss for the business. It would be limited to the amount of income, so it would be capped at $200,000 in that example. And this impact is also, like I had said, a timing issue. It would be picked up over the 5 or 7 year period of life of that asset, but it does accelerate deductions. The whole intent of this is to hopefully stimulate the purchase of equipment, therefore get more people back to work, get more equipment back, and get the businesses going in that situation.
I might add on that one that I think we're sort of expecting we're not going to see that used all that much this year. Most businesses are lucky to be breaking even at all, so we're not really sure that that one's going to have much of an impact, that anybody will be doing it. I said, I think as we come out of the recession, that's where we may see people being able to buy some new equipment. Right now, they're trying to make payroll, not buying that new equipment in the first place. So,
right. If we go to page 8, the top of page 8, code section 382, there are a couple of provisions here. This gets somewhat technical, but the federal tax law was changed several years ago when businesses started buying other businesses that had these federal net operating losses in them. They would go out, in essence, hunting for these businesses that they could purchase and then use those losses against their more profitable parts of their business in order to get the benefit from them. The federal government made changes to, in essence, cap the ability of businesses that acquire other ones to do that. This law basically, in essence, relaxes some of those rules in the banking industry right now, where there's so much restructuring going on, where small banks are being purchased or banks that are in trouble are being purchased by other banks. Just allow a bit more flexibility, so it enables some of those banks to get purchased, and some of those net operating losses that were frozen in some of these banks from previous years to be utilized. I don't know if that revenue impact is much. It doesn't affect any other type of businesses that I can tell, other than just those in the banking industry.
Yes, Representative Berger.
So these provisions in Oregon would help if the purchase of a small struggling bank. I'm trying to look for its impact in Oregon. Okay.
I think it would encourage a bank that is going to be buying a bank that has had a loss. It would encourage that purchase. You're going to have your small local banks. This could also impact in a situation like Washington Mutual, where it's taken over. Oregon's going to have some portion of it that's going to be Oregon taxable income. So I think there's going to be both big banks. Those are, you know, again, it's going to be a percentage, and we don't have any idea what that may be. But for your local banks that will have a loss, it will encourage somebody to come in and take that business over. Right now we're seeing more that they're just selling off the assets and not by taking over the bank. So it's a very different, and they're not taking the loans with it, and it is more of a struggle for businesses. So, you know, we would hope that this was, it would encourage them to actually take over the bank. Whether that happens, we don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Directly under that, Code Section 529, having to do with the tuition programs, this is one of these small items that was shoved into the stimulus package to allow individuals that are paying out of a 529 plan to include not only tuition and other costs, but also the costs of technology, in essence, computers to be used as well. At this point, we're disconnected from this provision. So if an individual with a child in college decided to use some of their money, let's say $3,000 for a nice new laptop for their student going to Oregon State or University of Oregon, that would, at this point, be taxable in Oregon because it wouldn't be qualified to be used, and it would not be taxable in the federal government, so it would be an add-back, in essence, for those things in Oregon. No idea what the revenue impact would be, but it's one of these things that's probably, more than anything else, kind of a trap for the unwary. It's one of these items that's probably was unanticipated that this would be that much of an issue, but I could see this as being something that crops up quite a bit in the 2009 year as parents are trying to make the money go as far as possible, and tapping the 529 or the money inside these 529 plans is probably their biggest item to use.
And this is the first time I've heard of this particular provision, but I know there's a lot of other provisions in the stimulus bill that I've never heard of and may never hear of. Yeah.
And stimulus bill's over 1,000 pages long. Yeah. There are things in there that probably we're not aware of yet either at this point.
I actually attempted to wade through a piece of it on the Internet. Gave up after a couple of sections.
And yeah. Luckily, we just had to deal with the tax section, so right. It made it a little easier.
The next one going back is probably section 1374 towards the bottom there. This is sort of an odd provision that came in here that temporarily reduces a built-in gain tax holding period for these S corporations. This is going to be a small segment of the small businesses that would be affected by this, but any time that a regular corporation changes from a regular C corporate status to an S corporation status, the differences between the values of the assets that are held by these businesses when they make this changeover. Let's assume that they had a piece of real property in that corporation that had a tax basis of $1 million, but the fair market value at that time was $5 million. So, in essence, what happens is that under current law, to the point of stimulus, if that corporation were to have sold that piece of property within a 10-year period, then that $4 million difference between the basis on the and the fair market value at that time would have to be taxed inside the corporation just like it was a C corporation. So they would pay tax at the corporate level and then pay tax again at the shareholder level. This provision just relaxed that 10-year holding period from 10 to 7. What was interesting about it is that it made it retroactive. So for a corporation that is 7 years now through its situation, it could now, in this seventh year, sell that piece of real property and not have to pay that double taxation. Oregon, you would still have to hold it for the 10-year period. And so I don't know how much this would be affected by anyone, but this is definitely one of those issues that probably... wasn't thought of. It's a little odd, definitely.
Representative Bennett? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm quite familiar with this section, and I have many folks who are somewhere in that 10-year waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
So it would probably have been more meaningful if there was a market for these assets they would now like to sell.
I think that's why this has come in. It is an odd time for them. It's a very interesting provision that they added.
Yes.
We would agree with you, and I think amongst the CPAs, we really feel it's not going to have a big impact. If you felt like you needed to sell it, you probably already did, and this isn't the time. And if you did, it's not going to have much appreciation in it right now.
Is this a permanent reduction of the holding period or a temporary?
No, it is not. It's just a temporary. And so it's just, and then it'll pop back up, I think.
Okay.
And so it's just for those, it kind of shortens it for those that are in that interim period. But overall, we still have a 10-year holding period.
So I'm a new S corporation. It used to be a C corp.
You're still going to have 10 years.
And I have property that fits this qualification that we've now held for 7 years. This year and next year, under the federal rule, I could sell it and use the pass-through provisions of the S corporation. In 11, because it would be the ninth year, I would be back under the old rule.
For that 1 year.
Yes.
And also, if you were an S corporation and you were in year 5 of your S corporation,
this doesn't apply anyway. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So it's a very interesting provision.
Yeah.
We were surprised to see that in there as well. I think the last thing I'm going to talk about just for a second is on page 10 at the very top, code section 35. Health insurance costs eligible to individuals and actually going down, code section 139 and 4980, they're all sort of tied together. This deals with the COBRA benefits that individuals receive after they leave employment. Because of the current situation where unemployment is rising, the federal government allowed for COBRA benefits to be extended and to give employers, in essence, a credit to provide additional coverage for those individuals. If you'll notice on Section 139C, it says the COBRA subsidy that we're talking about here would not be included in gross income for individuals. Normally for individuals, anything that they receive from an employer is taxable income and would have to be included in income tax, which would include COBRA benefits later on to the extent that they're not segregated out of the taxable rules by the federal government specifically. So in this situation, the federal government allowed for additional COBRA benefits to be extended longer and to allow employers to get a credit for it. To the extent that these extended benefits are outside of the stimulus, the new stimulus rules, as far as we could tell, they would be taxable fringe benefits to Oregon. And these are going to be individuals that had just been laid off. So Oregon would tax these COBRA benefits. The federal government would not tax these COBRA benefits. Don't know how many individuals we're talking about and exactly what the, or even theoretically what the revenue impact would be on this. But this is also one of these unintended consequences type situations that no one probably had thought about too much when this thing was originally passed.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Berger.
Let me understand this, because this is not an area that I'm very familiar with. Currently, COBRA is taxable. Currently, COBRA is taxable. I know how that works. to the individual receiving it?
Generally, COBRA benefits the individual. So if I'm laid off, I need to go pay my COBRA benefits, and I'm paying for my health insurance. And so this new provision says the reality is those individuals can't afford their health insurance. And so we're going to have the employer pay 65% of it, and the employee would just, the terminated employee would pay 35%, with the hope that by reducing the cost that the employee would be able to get that health insurance and continue it for generally a period of 18 months. The federal provisions then are set up so that the employer can get a credit for that from the federal government. So the federal government is ultimately going to be paying back the employer through the withholding provisions. It's a very unique way that they've handled this. But because the employer is giving it to the employee, it's taxable fringe benefit to the employee that they're receiving. And so that's the concern, is that one of those unintended consequences. But that's how all of the COBRA benefits, this is actually retroactive for those who were terminated from September of 2008 on. They're working through the provisions. The Department of Labor is supposed to be any day now issuing a notice that employers will need to go back and give those employees the right to elect into this health insurance coverage. So this is kind of trying to help those people that have lost their jobs to get those benefits.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
please.
This is very complicated, and particularly since the date that we disconnected and when we, and I'm telling you, Mr. Chair, specifically why I'm asking about this, because I just heard from a constituent who was just laid off, and she's struggling with this COBRA issue, and so this has immediacy for me.
Sure.
So basically, she would pay under these provisions if everything was working, and she's certainly not even aware of this, and I'm just becoming aware. Her employer presumably could pay 65% of her COBRA, get a credit for it. She would pay 35%, and the other 65% would be taxable.
Right. So right now, the way it sits for your constituent, she is entitled to these benefits because this is a federal provision. And so, and the employer will ultimately have to notify her within a short period of time. Again, they're working out all those notices. She will receive notice she's eligible. If she elects the COBRA benefits, she has to actually elect that I want to pay them, and I will pay 35%, and I will send a check every month to my employer equal to 35% of the health insurance benefits, and then the employer has to take 65% out of their pocket and then go back to the federal government and get a credit. So that will all still happen. But because we're disconnected, then to that employee, it's a taxable fringe benefit. So just for her Oregon purposes, we would expect there would have to be an add back line on that Oregon income tax return for next year to say, okay, but for Oregon, it's still taxable. But she would still be entitled to it because regardless of what Oregon's doing, it's a federal provision. So she is still entitled to those benefits. It's purely a matter of if she does elect that and the employer does pay a portion, will she then have to pay Oregon tax on that? So
thank you for that.
So it is very complicated and working through it.
Even though this is health insurance, which normally isn't taxable to an employee, in a COBRA situation, it would be?
Well, because it's a fringe benefit, and the way the fringe benefits work, it's somewhat questionable, and I think that's where the IRS has said, usually anything that employee gets, as Keith says, is taxable,
yeah.
Unless there's an exclusion,
an
and that's why they've specifically excluded it out. Because at this point in time, also, they're not an employee. They're a terminated employee. And so I think as we were discussing, if this isn't connected in Oregon, does that mean, we think it does, that the W-2 for Oregon that the employer has to issue, is that going to be different for Oregon versus Washington? Or are they going to, or Oregon versus federal, or are they going to have to issue a 1099 just for Oregon? So I think that's where we feel there's so many unintended consequences of being disconnected. This being one, just the Section 529 plans when they withdraw, there's a lot of different things that by not being connected, suddenly someone's going to have taxable income that they don't know, and it's going to carry over for a lot of period of years where there's that nonconformity, and it's just very difficult it's difficult enough for CPAs to track it, but for your individual taxpayer or for those that are out of state, it's really complicated.
Paula?
Yes, that was the point I was going to make. I get a desperate letter from a constituent who's got four kids and a husband laid off, and she's been laid off, and she's worried about health benefits, and she's wading into these waters that are really heavy sailing for you folks. You can imagine what it looks like to the poor person who's just been unemployed, and I can't do anything about it, but it makes me angry. This should be simplified for folks.
Well, we may be able to do something about it. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that we have, whether we're connected or disconnected, we have Oregon subtractions and additions all down the page, and we could in fact reconnect with exceptions, mm-hmm. and we could disconnect with exceptions.
Sure.
So
and we already
it's
do.
Not a yes. We do in fact every time we connect or disconnect, we make exceptions to that. And,
right.
And I just wanted to point that out. It's not a all or nothing situation.
Thank you. And of course. If I could say it in a slightly different way, I think one of the values of this kind of a meeting and this kind of a presentation is that it helps us to understand what some of those things are where we may very well decide that we want to reconnect in order to reduce the complexities for Oregonians.
Yeah.
And so we really appreciate the list that you're going through.
Yeah.
Your Representative Bantz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on your comment and to ask, we had a really interesting debate when we discussed connect-disconnect. And there seemed to be almost one good argument, then another good argument, both directions. So my question to you guys is, from a tax efficiency standpoint, which way do you recommend, that we remain connected and then go through the exception process, or disconnect and go through the partial reconnect process?
We strongly feel and have for years, we've been down here for 25, 30 years saying that connect is better. If you feel that you have to disconnect, we would really urge you to do a reconnect in general and then have to disconnect from those couple that you feel that you just can't take. Because if you just disconnect and then add back a couple, we're concerned that there's so many unintended consequences out there. This particular act, there weren't any pension provisions, but generally we have a pension provision. And if we're not connected, that means everybody's pension plan suddenly disqualified technically in Oregon. Well, that doesn't make sense. And again, completely unintended. It's not really a specific tax consequence, but it is. And so I think we would always urge you to stay connected. And I think it's the conformity issue and just the difficulty in complying. Back in the 70s, we did disconnect from the depreciation for a while, and just kind of a nightmare of keeping different depreciation schedules for Oregon versus federal. That was finally connected back because of the differences. But these are the things that we have to track. It's very difficult for individual taxpayers that are trying to track their own, or even if they move from one CPA to another and the depreciation schedules they're having to track those, it just becomes very complicated. So, again, we understand there's revenue impacts that you all are dealing with. But from our standpoint, we would urge you for conformity.
Yeah, I agree. Technology over the years has made a lot of this stuff a lot easier, even for small business owners and individuals. TurboTax and other programs have come along to make things a lot easier for a lot of constituents. But most business owners and most individuals think federal tax law first, and they do a lot of their planning that way to begin with. So being connected to federal tax law just gives most individuals the ability to do their economic and financial planning a whole lot easier, and then understand where Oregon has decided to disconnect makes it easier for planning on a go-forward basis. I know with most of my clients that's the way that we work through this, is you sort of take a look at what the federal provisions are first, and then, okay, how is Oregon different, and how do we deal with those issues?
I think if I might add, in those years where we haven't had what we've called the rolling reconnect, it becomes very difficult for taxpayers and their CPAs to know how to file a return. So, for example, right now you're connected at December 31, 2008. When we come to 2009, no one knows really how to file that return. Will you connect back at the next legislative session, or will you not? And so one way or another, people end up having to file amended return to take into account what's happened. Because in the past, we would connect retroactively back. And so because this stimulus package was passed in February, we're not tied to it right now. So unless there's some action taken, filing of next year's returns will be completely disconnected. And we see an awful lot of separate line items on that, Form 40 or Form 20 for the taxpayers. So I think one additional thing is that we sort of expect, and again, we don't know, but that the future tax bills we see coming from the IRS probably will be revenue raisers that should flow through to Oregon and help to be a revenue raiser. And so, again, if we're reconnected, those will get picked up. If not, we'll have to go back and pick those up and have a vote on those. So we expect, and again, we don't know for certain, that this was the one that kind of was going to impact us the most. And from here on, what we're hearing is that there will be revenue raisers out there.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you leave, you casually said Oregon would have some, might presumably have to have something instead of the federal W-2, some sort of a 1099. What was that?
This is just like on the COBRA, because they'd have a different income for Oregon versus Washington, and so how's that going to impact them?
Okay.
So it's just the taxable income thing. But it is from an employer, and so the employer usually has to notify. So I think there's just, again, all of those different pieces that we have to think through when we're not connected, and how would it tie out, and how does the Department of Revenue track all of that? So,
right, that makes sense. In the world we actually live in, of course, in addition to the CPA issues and the accounting issues, there also are the asymmetric voting requirements in Oregon because of Measure 25, mm-hmm. Which complicates our problem, and sometimes that cuts one way and sometimes it cuts another. So sometimes the constitutional requirements add another level of complexity that make the answer less obvious, perhaps.
I think that's true, and I think that's where we're thinking that if there are a lot of changes in the rest of the year that actually increase, it may
sure.
be easier to be connected. That
may very well be the case.
We don't know.
I take it you would support an amendment to the Constitution that would remove this kind of tax issue from the asymmetric voting requirements that Oregon's Constitution currently requires. But I won't actually ask you to answer that question. Maybe another day.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. And I'm not sure you were finished yet.
We are finished. That was the last provision that I was going to discuss.
We very much appreciate your hearing from us.
And you see me lean over to Chris and say, look into this one. A number of these we're going to look into, given the way you've raised them and the importance of them, and we'll see where we can go with that, either in this bill or in some other mechanism.
Okay.
Anything else, committee, for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your
Thank
help.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very much, and including the bedtime reading that we received that I'm sure will be a fascinating reading as members of the committee get to.
It will put you right to sleep.
Yeah, we loved it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2914? Okay, we'll close.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Berger, sorry.
I have prepared some amendments to this bill that I'd like to submit to the committee.
Perfect. Let's do it.
These amendments are starting a conversation about reconnecting on some of the provisions that we discussed today, specifically unemployment compensation and expensing of escorts, bonus depreciation, timing of depreciation, expensing for corporation taxpayers. These are all the issues that we discussed, and I would like to start a conversation about reconnecting with these by submitting the dash ones to the committee.
Great. That would be wonderful, and if you'll do that, then we'll have copies prepared and distributed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate a very timely notification of the proposal.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we all understand that, and you know how I feel about our disconnection, and I appreciate the discussion this morning. We are putting Oregon businesses in a second position as they go out and compete for business by taking away some of these provisions in our disconnection that clearly the federal government thinks we should be doing to get business going. Their philosophical basis is we need business, and we need business to be successful, and we want to help them. And I believe our disconnect is a huge step in the wrong direction on that, and I submit this in hopes that the committee understands. It isn't so much I'm trying to protect the revenues of the state as I am trying to protect the likelihood that going forward Oregon businesses will be here, be successful, and be hiring and their employees paying income tax thereby. So that's my desire here. So I'd like to start this conversation with this amendment and hope it continues quickly and we can get back on track.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And, of course, as I pointed out in my speech on the floor on closing on the bill that we did pass, the federal incentives are great and wonderful, and they get to run a big deficit in doing it. Our disincentives are very small by comparison, given that our tax rates are much lower, and we have a budget to balance. So our concerns are different, but I certainly appreciate the issues that you raise. I think they're important. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Call.
But there's just a nagging question that I have, and maybe staff can answer this. I'm wondering how many other states are in a similar situation to us with regards to having an income tax and having their tax keyed, connected to the federal system, such that when we decide to disconnect, we're putting ourselves at a competitive disadvantage with those other states. Do you have that information, or can you get it for me?
I can get specific information, but what I can tell you right now is that most states that have an income tax do tie to federal law in a similar fashion. And these kinds of conversations crop up in all of these states whenever these kinds of federal action is taken. So I don't know. I couldn't tell you right now which states have decided to decouple or not, but the discussions do occur in the other states, and very similar discussions are being had in those states.
I'd appreciate those numbers. That'd be very helpful,
Mr.
for me.
Chair.
Thank you,
Representative Berger.
But Chris, is it not true that Oregon is the one of the 50 states who is most dependent on the income tax as our single source of state, as a single source of state taxation?
Representative Berger, that's correct.
So this has incredible significance for us.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Do you want to go through this?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you also have in your packet a research brief put out by our office that goes through the provisions of the stimulus bill that had the larger revenue impacts or potential revenue impacts on Oregon. And it's broken down into those that would have a direct impact versus an indirect impact. And I don't know that we need to go through every one of these provisions because you just heard the Carrie and Keith describe them, but I would point out the revenue impact estimates that we currently have. And generally speaking, the direct impacts would that are listed in the table on the front would need to there would need to be some sort of affirmative action taken so that if the Assembly decided to tie to bonus depreciation, for example, those are the revenue impacts that I had when putting this together. Or the unemployment insurance would cost about $30 million, and so forth. The discharge of indebtedness, I would add to the information you already have, is that in looking up who would take advantage of these, most of the information out there suggests private equity firms would be the main recipients of that. So that revenue impact reflects an estimate of their footprint in Oregon as compared to nationally. The net operating loss piece already affects Oregon and is built into the March forecast because this piece doesn't affect the C corporations, affects the pass-through entities, and basically allows the pass-through entities to carry these losses back in prior years. So presumably when a taxpayer goes back and files an amended return for an old tax year at the federal level, they would do so for Oregon as well. And so that impact is already flowing through and is, as I said, incorporated into the March forecast. The reason it doesn't affect corporations is because we have our own carryback, our NOL provisions, and we don't allow carrybacks. And then the Section 179 expensing, I don't think I have anything to add there to what the accountant said. The earned income credit, this would be another place where the tie is that Oregon's earned income credit is 6% of the federal credit. And so if we don't tie there, then when calculating the 6% credit for Oregon, taxpayers would have to kind of figure they'd have their federal credit that they could take under federal law, and then the 6% wouldn't be of that federal piece. They would have to recalculate their federal credit under the old law. And so that's another place where taxpayers would have kind of two sets of what their earned income credit is. So that's another one of the unintended consequences would be a characterization.
Mr. Chair,
yeah, Representative Riley.
Question about that last statement. Our earned income tax credit is tied to federal law. It's 6% of federal earned income tax credit. Is there in our earned income tax credit law, is there a specific statement that it's tied to the federal as of the last time we were tied to the federal?
Correct, Representative Riley. It would be as of December 31st, 2008.
Thank you.
So that would be the difference.
That's what we did in the general bill. And that would apply to this provision.
Right.
Right.
That's of all the things that by tying to a specific that you have the taxable income and then everything else. The taxable income, as you know, is the rolling reconnect that you're allowed to have. Part of the everything else is the earned income credit. And so when calculating it right now, it would be 6% of the federal earned income credit as it existed in federal law on December 31st, 2008. And that's where the disconnect piece comes in.
Just simply increasing the federal earned income credit wouldn't make any change here. They must have changed the definition of some part of it, of earned income or something else. But what did they actually do?
They didn't change the definition. They changed the amount, the way that it's calculated.
Okay. And our EIC is based upon the amount of the federal EIC.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
So those are the larger impacts. Those are the direct impacts. Again, this brief doesn't go through every provision in the bill, just those with the larger revenue impacts. And then the second piece there are the indirect impacts. As you heard, generally everything that lowers or increases federal taxes can have an impact on Oregon through the federal tax subtraction. generally speaking, those indirect effects aren't very significant in terms of dollars because they have to be large changes. So unless you have something, for example, the Making Work Pay Credit, that will be providing a federal credit to Oregonians in the neighborhood of $675 million. So you have to get up to hundreds of millions of dollars in the change in federal tax before the indirect impact becomes significant. And by significant, I mean on the order of tens of millions of dollars. And so what this brief includes are four provisions of federal law that do have some kind of indirect impact. And the Making Work Pay Credit, on table four, or on page four, there's a table of estimated impacts by single filers and joint filers. I would point out this is very similar to the rebate checks that the Fed sent out in early 2008 as part of the economic stimulus bill in 2008. And so what we currently see now when taxpayers are filing their 08 tax returns, they have to exclude that federal rebate in terms of calculating their federal tax for their 2008 tax returns, in effect having a lower federal tax suppression, because that does lower their federal tax. It lowers their federal tax suppression, which lowers their deductions, which increases their Oregon taxable income. So that's kind of that indirect impact.
Brain has to work on.
Which is why we normally don't highlight these pieces unless they are of this magnitude, because anything that changes have a piece. A couple of others that are in here are the American Opportunity Credit, which is a change in the HOPE Education Credit. And that provides a credit for college expenses for the first 4 years of college. So it can be a junior, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. It's up to a $2,500 credit. For the first $2,000 of expenses, eligible expenses, it's 100% credit. And then for the next $2,000, it's a 25% credit. So it can be substantial there. And that is effective for tax years 2009 and 2010. So there we see an impact of a few million dollars in Oregon, potentially in indirect. And again, the indirects are already flowing through, and they're incorporated into the March forecast. And then the home buyer credit is one for first-time home buyers, where under prior law, taxpayers were eligible for a credit up to $7,500 that equal 10% of the purchase price up to $7,500. Under prior law, and this just started in 2008, it was kind of a no-interest loan where taxpayers got the credit, but then they had to repay it proportionally over a number of years. So there was no real impact. In the stimulus bill, it is no longer an interest-free loan in that the feds no longer require the payback. So it is just a regular credit, if you will, now.
Excuse me.
First-time buyer.
But these are all applicable in this tax year, whether we disconnect or whether we're these are all Oregonians are eligible for all this.
Yes, they're eligible for all of them. They're all federal provisions.
No matter what we do on the
right.
Reconnect. Okay, I just want to confirm that these are all, but they will impact.
The dollars here refer to the change in Oregon tax revenue.
Right.
All.
Okay. How it affects Oregon tax revenue.
Tax.
Got it. This is really heavy weather. I'm sorry.
Yes, it is. All of them reduce federal taxes, which have the effect of increasing the net revenue that flows through as Oregon taxable income.
Right.
Bottom line.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay.
And perhaps the last item there helps provide that example, because I think that all the committee members are familiar with what a significant issue the AMT is. And the federal AMT, and at the federal level, there was another one-year patch, which they increased the standard deduction. Basically, an AMT has an exemption amount, which acts like a standard deduction, and historically, that has not been indexed to inflation. So in 2009, that exemption was due to fall down due to reduce substantially, which would put a lot of people into the AMT. The feds increased that exemption amount from 08 levels by inflation, thereby keeping a lot of taxpayers out of the AMT. And then the indirect impact in Oregon is only about $1 million or so. Part of part of that is, most of that is, a lot of the AMT filers are already at the federal subtraction limit. But that's another example of where you have a big issue at the federal level, and in terms of the indirect impact on Oregon, it's relatively small. So, but clearly the largest indirect impact is in making pay credit. Right.
And those numbers are on the top of page 5 of your analysis, of your brief.
Yes.
It's interesting because the AMT bill that we've been looking at, I think, has significantly higher amounts that are that under our, of course, ours is written differently, but under, it would be exempt from the AMT anyway. Okay.
And the last two things, just in the context of the brief, were at the last page, what under a section of outstanding issues, and you heard Karen and Keith talk about them, and they pertain to the Section 382, these built-in losses, which were limited to banks. In this, basically, you had in the fall where the IRS allowed banks to use these built-in losses. Congress didn't really approve of that, so in this bill, they reversed that ruling. So as of January 16th, banks are no longer eligible for that. So they didn't repeal it retroactively because taxpayers rely on IRS advice, so they didn't want to go back and undo it, but they did say IRS was wrong and they overstepped their bounds. So effective January 16th, that's no longer effective. So in Oregon, because we're not tied to that repeal of the federal rule. So it's painful in that it sounds like a double negative. So there, that issue is out there. And then the last piece is this 65% subsidy for COBRA payments.
The one that we spent a lot of time on.
Yes.
Okay.
So I think you understand that piece.
Well, as much as we can understand any. Yes. Any other questions on the research brief? Did you want to go through this other LRO document today?
If you'd like, Mr. Chair, that was on Monday, I believe, when we heard, or when you heard 2066, there was some interest in some additional information on the urgency credit. So there are a couple pages down.
Okay, so when we open the hearing on that, we can deal with that issue. Oh, all right. Does that prompt anyone else to want to appear on House Bill 2914? I guess we've confused and cowed everyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2914, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2066.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you recall, on Monday when we heard House Bill 2066, there were some questions about some of the technical aspects and mechanics of how the Earned Income Credit works, and how changing it from 6% to 18% might affect some Oregonians. So there, in your pack, there's a two-page, double-sided handout just of some more detail on the EIC. So just to go through that briefly, and again to provide context, the federal earned income credit was created in 1975. It was meant to be, at the time, it was a temporary refundable credit against Social Security taxes. And it was renewed each year in 76 and 77, and by 78 it became permanent. And there were changes made to it where the maximum credit was increased. Taxpayers were allowed to take an advanced earned income credit through their paychecks through the withholding program. In 1986, the income limits and the phase-outs became indexed to inflation. Prior to that, they were fixed. In 1990, there were adjustments made to family size, as the credit exists now, and we'll get into this a little bit more. It depends on the number of qualifying children as to the amount of credit a person is eligible for. In 1993, it became eligible for the first time for people without children. And then in 2001, there was a lot of concern about the so-called marriage penalty, so the married phase-out range was changed. I have some graphs here that attempt to illustrate some of those aspects. The eligibility criteria for the credit, individuals do have to have earned income or AGI up to a certain maximum, and then the credit phases out. So it's focused for low-income people. and the dollar amounts that are listed there, about $13,000 for no children, $34,000 if you have one child, and $38,000 if you have more than one child. And those are single amounts. And for the joint filers, it's $3,000 more. The definition of earned income includes wages and salaries and self-employment income. And then there is a cap on the amount of investment income a person can have. They can't have no more than roughly $3,000 of interest and dividends and some passive income. There are a lot of requirements around the qualifying child. They must meet relationship, age, and residency tests. Relationship, basically, they have to be a child, a grandchild, either natural child or adopted child, foster child. And for their age, they have to be either under age 19 or under age 24 if they're a student, and then they have to live with the taxpayer for at least half the year. And if you don't have a qualifying child, the requirements are to be between the ages of 25 and 26 and not be a dependent, so that's how the high school kid working at McDonald's that isn't eligible for the earned income credit. And also, they can't be a qualifying child of another taxpayer, so there's not a kind of double dipping, if you will. And then they have to live within the U.S. for half the year. The chart there shows the ramp up and the plateau and the phase out range. Basically, as earned income, those three sections of the credit, as earned income increases, the value of the credit increases. So that's meant to be an incentive to work. And then it reaches a plateau of, for example, if you have two or more children, of around $4,800. And then for one child, about $2,900, and then it's much smaller for no children. But you have this plateau range so that while this stretch of income as earned income increases, the credit is not reduced. It's held steady. So in that sense, the credit is neutral with respect to an incentive to work. And then you hit a phase-out range. And that's where for each dollar of earned income, the credit starts to reduce, and that's how it gets phased out. And that there's been, and I'll touch on this in a little bit, there's been a lot of research on this apparent disincentive to work. So those are the three ranges. So visually, that's how the credit works. And the solid line versus the dashed line. The dashed line are single filers, and the solid line represents the joint filer. So basically, the joint filers have a longer time period where the credit stays at the maximum. And then on the next page, briefly, the Oregon history, the credit was created in 1997 as a non-refundable 5% credit. Since 2006, it's been refundable, and in 2008, it was increased to 6%, and currently it's set to schedule to sunset in 2014. And so that chart there, the pattern will be the same. It's just a 6% credit, so the scale is a lot smaller, where the maximum Oregon credit is $290. So it's the same shape. The next chart down there compares the 6% credit and an 18% credit for those claiming one child. And basically, it holds that same shape. It just increases, so that maximum credit for these filers increases from about $175 to just over $500, a tripling of the credit. But that same shape where you still have these three phases of the credit.
So that's the bill, is it?
That's what the bill would do.
For
each, I didn't include a chart for all of them, because one probably more than enough. But,
right.
Yes.
But it would have similar effect on the two or more children. It would be
exactly.
A higher line.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. But this is the box that represents what this bill would do as drafted.
Correct.
Thank you.
And then on the next chart, a couple of examples. just to try and highlight exactly different phases of the credit. So the first example, we have somebody with AGI of just under $8,300, household A. And I've included in there's a lot of discussion about poverty level and the impact of the credit. So I've included poverty levels for these households. And so this person is earning $8,300. They have one child. And the poverty level comparison is $14,000. So at the federal level, they have no taxable income and no gross tax. And then their net tax is negative $2,814, the effect of the earned income credit. I have, as I guess as a disclaimer, as with the examples from last week, I've simplified and tried to focus this on the earned income credit. There are a number of aspects that I've ignored here for these purposes, just to, for simplification. When this person earns an additional $2,000, it doesn't affect their taxable income. They're still at zero, but their earned income credit increases by $103. So here they've earned $2,000 more, and their federal liability, if you will, actually goes down by $103. Now, following that down to Oregon, at the $8,300 income level, they have a gross tax of $263. The personal exemption credit wipes that out, and then they have their $169 refundable credit in Oregon. And that then the $2,000 of additional income for this person results in a smaller refundable credit. So in that sense, their tax increases, if you will, from minus 169 to minus 121. They're still getting a refundable credit. It's just less. And household B, we have somebody at 16,536. That's the minimum wage for the full year. Two children. And again, at the federal level, they have no taxable income and no gross tax. And their earned income credit is much higher at $4,659. And so that's all refundable at the federal level. If this person earns $2,000 more, they start to get into a range where, at the federal level, they start to have some gross tax. Again, this is excluding child credits, which overlaps a lot with this particular group. But they still have, what we see here is that the earned income credit falls from $4,659 down to $4,237. And so their tax difference is $426. Because their refundable credit falls by that amount, and this is where the credit's phasing out, and their marginal tax rate at this point is 21%. All right, where we take the 426 divided by the 2,000. And so that's where some of the literature has looked at that incentive, because on the face, that might be a disincentive to work, facing those marginal tax rates.
Mm-hmm.
And in Oregon, a similar story where at the 16,000, they have a net tax of $44 because their earned income credit isn't sufficient to wipe out their liability. And then the $2,000 results in a tax increase of $184, which is a 9.2% tax rate. So that same effect exists in Oregon, just to a much smaller degree. Now, on the joint filers, here we have family for $20,000 of income. Similar story, where at the federal level, they have no tax. And the comparison here is going from a 6% credit to an 18% credit. Doesn't affect their federal taxation level. But in Oregon, they go from a net tax of $107 down to a refundable amount of $440. So in tripling the credit from 6% to 18%, they go from owing $107 to getting a check for $440. And a lot of the conversation about lifting people out of poverty level refers to the amount of credits being income, and that gets added to the income, and then that puts them above the poverty level. And then the last example there is just to show at the end, as the credits are getting phased out. So here we have an AGI of $41,000. That poverty level should actually be 21,200, a formula problem there. It's not 17,600.
Oh. So the third number in the column is wrong.
Yes, because it's the joint A and joint B are both the same family size.
Right.
So here their gross tax at the federal level is $1,482. No change increasing the credit from 6 to 18%, but in Oregon, their earned income credit goes from $8 to $24. So there's still an impact for families at the $40,000 range, but it gets pretty small. It's starting to be eliminated by that point, and that's at the tail end of that phase out range.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and then just lastly, here's some very briefly information on the 2006 Oregon and federal claimants. These are from Oregon returns. The lighter shade there is the amount of the credit that was refundable, and the darker is the non-refundable portion. So you can see the refundable portion is really concentrated on those with incomes of less than $15,000, and then once you start getting to the $15,000-$20,000 dollars of income, more of the credit is in the non-refundable piece. But for these same taxpayers, nearly all of the federal credit is refundable. So it's in excess of 90% of their credit is refundable.
And that's because federal taxes actually start at a higher level than state taxes.
Exactly.
Do. All right. Other questions, comments on this report? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to be heard today on House Bill 2066? I think we pretty much got them in when we heard the bill the first time. Anything from the committee? As you may guess, we're continuing to look at where this may take us, and it's very interesting numbers today. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2066. And we've exhausted our agenda. The committee is adjourned until Tuesday. Is that right? Tuesday? Till Tuesday.
Yeah.